This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he is every show, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, you look like you're sleeping there. Is everything okay?
Oh, sorry, Chris. It's probably just because I'm getting older. My birthday
is
just in a couple of days, and I'm just having a hard time work these days. You know, I'm so old.
So it wasn't like a vision from the prophets or anything like that.
I was having a very vivid dream about a sandwich, but I don't think that was from the prophets. Although there were a lot of locusts on the sandwich, so that was awkward.
That's pretty disgusting.
Yeah, it's... But then they flew away.
And then they carried the sandwich to Cardassia.
Exactly, but then they flew away and it was okay.
Well, we are going to talk about locusts a little bit today because we're going to talk about the episode Rapture and how it's a turning point for Sisko. And Matthew, you suggested that we talk about this, and I was thinking, sure, we can talk about turning points for Sisko, but I'm sure we've talked about Rapture before or done a commentary. And then I looked through the list, and it's nowhere to be found in The Orb. We've talked about it as part of a group of episodes before, but we've never focused exclusively on this, as far as I remember.
No, I was so surprised when I thought about this episode that we hadn't done anything on it before. I'm pretty sure you guys have done a Ready Room on it.
We did.
And yeah. It's so funny that we haven't, and I know we've mentioned it in other episodes, but this really is the turning point, the pivot point for the entire series and for Sisko. And so I'm really excited to talk about with you, Chris, because, you know, I really think this is the episode where Sisko embraces the role and the role of emissary. And so I kind of wanted to just talk about that with you, because this is, you know, anytime you read a religious text or a story where somebody has some sort of conversion or something, there's a moment where everything kind of changes for them and they embrace it fully. And what's so interesting to me about this episode is that is this moment for Sisko, where everything about being the emissary finally just snaps into place because of the religious experience that he has with the prophets, Valhalla, and the visions he's getting. And I think that makes for just an amazing, incredible Star Trek story, because it's so different.
It's very, very different, for sure. The Ready Room you're talking about, just for those who want to catch that as well after you listen to this, is Ready Room 145. It's called Visions from an Alien God, and it's from about 2 years ago. So I no longer remember what I said on that episode 2 years ago, although I'll probably repeat myself a little bit here. But yeah, like you said, Matthew, it is very different here. It's made very clear how this differs from the usual Star Trek story in the fact that we have Admiral Whiteley visiting the station, because we get to see traditional Star Trek's direct point of view about what's happening with Sisko. And it's almost like this is what Star Trek thinks about a character who's human, who's a Starfleet captain, who is on an alien world and has become part of the religion of that world. And we also see the conversation between Kira and Miles and Jadzia and Worf, which I know you put in the show notes, in fact, where we also get to see that contrast between the two points of view and how they've been intertwined throughout Deep Space Nine. And then they built up to this point, which becomes the turning point, because starting with Destiny on through Accession on to Rapture here, we've been sort of building up this idea that Sisko might really buy into the fact that he's the emissary, and that we finally get there.
Well, it's almost like, you know, we've talked about the idea that Sisko is very much a Moses type figure, and you know, Moses has a long history with God, and slowly
they're
coming
real tight.
Yeah, Matthew, and yeah, they become real tight at the end. But I mean, he has an interesting path of, you know, disobedience and frustration, and you know, but there's that one moment where he has the experience that is beyond all experiences for him, where I think he finally realizes what he's involved in. And it's the moment where he's getting the Ten Commandments from the Lord, and he asks, you know, to be able to see the Lord. The Lord says, no, you can't see me. And he is the only person who even just gets to see the back of God. And even that, his face is shining, basically, when he comes down from the mountain. And this is so reminiscent of what happens in this episode, is that Sisko has had he's having these revelations from the prophets, and he's getting closer and closer to the answer. And the way that they even shoot the episode, there's kind of a glow about Sisko and about the episode after the visions start to happen. And I just think it's so interesting because it's playing so well with the religious motifs that they're using and they're probably pulling from as writers. And it's telling a really compelling story because, again, you know, we've not had a lot of religion in Star Trek before this. It's always kind of been treated as, you know, well, that's just myth or whatever. But here, we're having to deal with the reality of it, that this is something that's not something you can just, you know, say, oh, that's just a myth or whatever. No, this is something in your face. It's still here. And I think that makes it really interesting as well, because I think Starfleet, for the most part, seems to be kind of more of a homogenous society than we think of for the most part. Like, most people don't really believe in any kind of religious anything, like a god or whatnot. And for them, it seems like mumbo jumbo and nonsense. And so when they're really put to the test about whether they're going to respect somebody in their beliefs, they kind of veer on the side of being really intolerant almost. And I thought that was so interesting, again, for Star Trek to be discussing.
And realizing that this is something we can't push aside was driven home near the end of the episode when Sisko returns to the station and he walks up to Admiral Whatley and he says, don't worry about your son, he forgives you. And Whatley asks Bashir, well, how did he know that Kevin and I weren't getting along? Well, that's the moment when the Admiral realizes that there is something going on in there, right? It's not a mystical thing that we can just dismiss. There actually is something to this. The point about the Federation being homogenous and being intolerant to someone who doesn't share the idea that all religion is myth, that's an interesting discussion, and maybe it's one for another episode, because I think that that is true of Starfleet officers, and those are the people that we see all the time because they've been through this training. I wonder about the actual people who live on each individual planet, including Earth, in the 24th century. What kind of diversity remains there? What kind of views remain? Who still believes in the supernatural or religions? because I suspect that actually there is a lot of diversity still there, but we don't get to see it because it does go sort of against the original vision of Star Trek.
Well, and that's what makes the idea of the Federation so interesting. You know, when you think about it, the Federation itself is something that you have to believe a certain set of beliefs to be in the Federation. You know, just the same way as if, you wanted to become an American, you have to take a test and, you know, all this kind of stuff. Or if you wanted to join the United States as a country and we were going to add you as a new state here, you would have to join and sign on to our constitution, our laws, and all that stuff. In the same way, the same thing with the Federation. And so there is a moral code. There's a center that the Federation and Starfleet hold to, that if you don't hold to that, well, you can't be a part of our group. And so it is, in some ways, exclusive. And I think that's so interesting. And that's the way it has to be all over the place, because we have to agree on a set code or we can never... We couldn't even exist, you know?
Right.
And so I think that is what's so interesting, is there is a point to where you can't have infinite diversity, really, and infinite combinations, because it doesn't work. You know, there has to be a place where the Federation would say, well, we don't agree with that, so you can't be part of our group. I'm sorry. You know?
Yeah. Well, I would argue that
you can be that way, but you're just not going to be able to be part of the Federation.
Well, that's the thing, right? I would argue that you can have infinite diversity and infinite combinations, but that diversity cannot necessarily be put into a union.
Right,
so
exactly.
When you're talking about planets, you can have, there is essentially an infinite number of planets in the universe. Of course, it is finite, but it's a number that to our human brains would seem infinite. And even the number of habitable planets is so large in the entire universe, we may never discover them, but they're there, that there is the potential for essentially infinite diversity. The combinations part may be difficult, right? Because you have to bring those things together, and there's always going to be strife and conflict. It's just the nature of life. So while it is an ideal to strive for, it's one that's very difficult to achieve.
Yeah, I mean, you just look at Earth, you know. I mean, we have to come to some sort of, we have to find the common ground to build on to be able to come together. And, you know, if you can't find the common ground, well, you go your separate ways. And so I think that's a really interesting thing when we're talking about this idea of the Federation, and then especially looking at Deep Space Nine with the way that Sisko is being looked at, you know, as he's embracing this role. And I think what makes it so fascinating to me is the way in which the prophets and the Bajoran people and the faith of the Bajorans wins Sisko over slowly. And I think it's, you know, for a lot of people that I have seen in my life, conversion to religion, And for me, being a Christian, to Christianity, as I've seen a lot of people, that takes time. It's not just like a snap of the fingers, you know, most of the time. And but, Sisko has that experience.
But the reverse is true as well, because for me, it was the other way around. Mm-hmm. I was raised Southern Baptist, and then I moved away from it over time as well. So it's not just a conversion towards religion, but it can also be a conversion away from religion.
Yeah,
that happens.
That's very true.
In both cases, it generally takes time. But there is sort of a moment where there's some sort of clarity, and then you finally make the decision to go one way or the other.
Right. Because in the end, I mean, it's you're choosing whatever belief system it is that you're going to have. And the most important decision that anybody ever makes in their life, because it will be the basis of all their other beliefs, is what they believe about there being a God, and if there is one or there isn't one. And you either believe that there isn't one and your belief system is built on that, or you believe there is one and your belief system is built on that. It's just depending on which one you choose. And so it is, yeah, you're right. It's very interesting to watch how people make that decision. And what's so great, I think, about Star Trek, Deep Space Nine is, especially with Sisko, is you get to watch somebody slowly become a believer in a faith, and it's shown as being reasonable, you know, and not crazy and not stupid or any of those things. It's so respectful, and they do a great job of respecting each side, and I think that's what makes Star Trek show true tolerance here in Deep Space Nine, more so than any of the other shows that we have, is because it shows that true diversity means that you aren't always going to agree about things, but you don't think somebody's stupid because they believe in a God and you don't, or vice versa. And I think that's pretty wonderful when you're looking at Sisko, especially in this role, because Admiral Whatley really thinking that Sisko's off his rocker, you know? I mean...
Yeah. And speaking of Admiral Whatley, that the one weak point for me in this episode is I really wish they had cast Admiral Whatley better, because the actor's delivery of the lines is so stilted that it... Especially against Avery Brooks. I mean, my goodness.
Yeah.
Playing against Avery Brooks. Wow. But anyway, so let's talk a little bit more about Sisko himself here. They use a technological trigger, in a sense, to give him that moment, in that it's the short-circuiting of the isolinear rod that sends this charge through his body that sort of sends him on these visions, although Chris, he was sort of already on his way there in the first place.
Do you call that the divine spark?
The divine spark. I think that is indeed what happened to him there. But that's sort of a technological trigger because the story is set in the 24th century. But do you see that as being similar to any historical accounts of figures in religious history who have had those moments that triggered them to, say, a moment of clarity?
Yeah, I can think of a few. You know, I think of the classic Moses in the burning bush. That's an interesting technological,
that's the one I think
of technological trigger. talk about advanced technology. Or I think of something that's a little bit different, but in the same vein of Elijah. He's in the wilderness. He's run away from Queen Jezebel, and he's hiding in the desert, and he's hiding in a cave that he's been brought to by the Lord, and he's been out there for a very long time, and he's just waiting to hear from the Lord, and there's a huge storm, and God's not in the storm. There's a huge wind. God's not in the wind. Then there's just a still, small voice on the breeze in the end, and that's where the voice of God was. So yeah, and things aren't where we expect them to be, you know, and this is very unexpected. But I love the way in which Sisko, as the emissary, fulfilling the prophecies here in unique and interesting ways that when they were written, nobody would have expected to happen from a computer console giving him a shock.
Yeah.
But that's the way in which the prophets worked to bring about finding Ahala and, you know, giving him the message about what was best for Bajor at this point. So it's just, it's so wonderfully done the way that it respects religion and yet at the same time continues to stay Star Trek, you know, and tell us a really interesting story. And for Sisko's character, continue him down that path to, I would say at this point, he is fully and completely the emissary. Like, there's nothing in Sisko that really rejects that idea after this point.
Yeah. See, I would say that he was always fully the emissary, but that's a retroactive reading of the series. And the question I want to ask you now is that watching Rapture after knowing how the entire story turns out, when you see what's happening here, do you feel that this is a moment where the prophets, because they know what's coming up, we get a preview of it here in the episode when Sisko talks about the locusts, filling the sky and the locusts going to Bajor. And Bajor must not join the Federation because they have to stand alone or they will be destroyed. It's all really foreshadowing the Dominion War. I see the locusts as representing the Dominion fleet because the Jem'Hadar ships look like insects.
Yes,
the spider ships
look
like insects. And when they arrive, if you remember, when they arrive, we think they're coming to the station, but they turn and the fleet goes to Cardassia. And also, it's only because Bajor signs a non-aggression treaty with the Dominion that they are able to survive the Dominion War. And that's what, again, they're standing alone. It's being foreshadowed here. So the prophets know that all this is coming up. So back to my original question, which I began. Do you see this as that moment where the prophets are stepping in and making sure that they have Sisko completely on his path, and also they have the Bajoran people fully buying in to the fact that he's the emissary? Because here, Kai Winn finally, at this moment in time, believes.
That's a great question. I really like that read and that idea. And I agree with what you're saying earlier, is that Sisko is always the emissary. Now, if he accepts himself being the emissary,
he doesn't know.
He doesn't. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think this is the moment where he finally makes that turn and that switch. And so, yes, I like that. I like the idea of that this is a place where the prophets kind of do find a way to, as you said, step in to our world, make sure things happen, and move him along his path, move him along home. And so...
so inside that kind of white, cloudy environment, everyone is yelling, "A la Moraine"? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, exactly. They are singing the song.
But this is a critical moment because Bajor is going to sign the papers in that tiny little room to join the Federation. And if that happens, well, things aren't going to turn out the way they're supposed to. So the prophets have to step in.
Well, and this is what's so fascinating too, is that, you know, we've talked about the idea of them being outside of space and time, and was their meeting with Sisko originally, is that what allowed them to then kind of what we would think of as retroactively go back and do things?
Right.
And I think that that's true, because, you know, they've sent these specific orbs, and every time Sisko has an experience with one, it moves him along the path. And so he has the orb of prophecy here, which is enabling him to bring into focus what he needs with these visions and clearly get the message. And I think that's really fascinating when you really start to picture the power that these, you know, alien beings have because they're outside of space and time. And, you know, I think in the end, makes me wonder what exactly was it about their meeting with Sisko that made them choose to take on Bajor as a protectorate, a place that they would invest so much in, you know, if that's the reading that we go with. Because I think that's a really fascinating question.
Yeah, and I have a few ideas on that. That could be a topic for another show.
Yeah, that we're just bringing up topics all over the place, Chris.
Right there. I want to bring one other thing in at this moment in the discussion, because for me, it ties in, and I never thought about it until I was watching the episode to prepare today. And this is something that we talked about briefly on the other side of the orb, but the fact that Cassidy comes back, and you mentioned before the show that at the beginning of the episode, he's not so sure about Cassidy. Yeah, she's coming back. You know, Jake is trying to encourage him, and Benjamin's like, maybe it'll be good, maybe not. But after he's having these visions, she walks into the holosuite. He goes up and kisses her. He wants to take her down to Bajor. Cassidy's very important to the prophet's plans because she's going to be the mother of the emissary's child. So if the prophets are stepping in at this point to make sure that everything is on course as it should be, I think they are influencing how Benjamin feels about Cassidy and the fact that she's arriving at this very specific moment in time.
That's a really good thought. And you know, it's interesting because when you have a deeply religious experience, and for a lot of people, when you have somebody that might be tough for you to forgive,
yeah,
somebody in a religion where grace is a huge part of it and forgiveness, when you realize how much you've been forgiven, you find it much easier to forgive others. And so it's almost like this religious experience that Sisko's having is opening his eyes to a lot of things he hasn't seen before and understood. And there's something about that experience that has opened his heart back up to Cassidy. It allows Sisko to just be able to let go of the things that he needs to let go of to accept Cassidy back into his life. And I think that is it. I don't know if it's so much the prophets manipulating him the way they did his father. I don't think that's what's happening, but I do think they've given him some sort of clarity in that situation that has helped him to be able to just let go and embrace not only his role as emissary, but Cassidy as somebody who will become his wife.
Well, they need to bring them together.
Let's get together. Sorry, I didn't mean to sing Grease. My bad.
So that's something that stood out to me this time. Talking more about Sisko embracing his role as emissary, his obsession with finding Bahala is interesting. But what's even more interesting is the level of knowledge that he already has about Bajoran culture and Bajoran religion and Bajoran history. For someone who didn't want to be there in the first place, over the course of 5 years, he really has invested a lot of himself into this culture that deifies him.
Well, I guess it would be hard not to want to kind of know about the culture that thinks you're some kind of demigod, sort of.
But you could shun it. You could push it away. Like, I'm not the emissary. I don't want to have anything to do with this. That would be one way to handle it.
No, definitely. And I think he kind of does that for a little bit. You know, I feel like the first...
Oh, he does early on.
Yeah, first season, kind of a little bit into the second season, he's just not quite as comfortable. But there's some... And it'd be interesting to do a rewatch of the show and just kind of track, okay, where's the moment where he starts to be somewhat okay with it?
Yeah. Well, bit by bit, like Explorers.
Yeah.
He's kind of interested in how did that ship work, right? And it's just bit by bit. And then Destiny, I think, is a turning point, because with Destiny, he doesn't believe this prophecy, right? And then it seems like it happens. Maybe it's coincidence, maybe it's not, but it wasn't. His reaction wasn't like, nah, that's still just a myth. You know, that's not possible. It was like, there's something to this.
Yeah, no, and I feel like it's, I kind of feel like, you know, if you have that roommate that, you know, likes a certain book and, you know, like, I don't know if I'm really going to like this. So when they're not around, you start reading it just to see if you see something you'd like. I almost feel like that's Sisko with the prophets and Bajor and all the prophecies and stuff. He's like, I don't know if I'm going to really like this, but he kind of starts dabbling in it, you know? Like, it's like he picked up the Bajoran Bible and starts reading it, you know? He's like, I'm not going to be convinced by it, but I feel like it's just, it all of a sudden it starts to happen, you know? He lets more and more of it in. He begins to study it more and more. I think he does become fascinated with the culture of Bajor. Obviously, you mentioned Explorers. I think that's as a huge part of it. Seeing how ingenious these people are, what the prophets seem to have done for these people and giving them a pretty good life, a tranquil life before the Cardassians had come. They were an incredibly smart people and beautiful culture with music and art and architecture and spring wine. I mean, come on, who doesn't like the spring wine? So I think there's something about them that just drew him in. And I think that's what's really fascinating to see, again, is, you know, that happens to a lot of people with certain religions. You know, people might just one day, you know, I kind of want to know what this whole Bible thing's about. So they pick it up, they start reading it, and before you know it, it becomes something that they can't let go of.
Yeah. And taking the religion out of it, that happens to people in other cultures too. If you live in another culture long enough, you become more interested in it, you start to learn more about it, eventually you sort of assimilate into it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I could move to England and before you know it, I'd be saying hello and eating bangers and eggs every morning. So.
And then you'd go back to America, you would make your Megxit. And it would be over. So.
That's right. That's right. My Megxit. That's right. Matt is leaving Britain.
So there's also a question here, and this would be something for Zachary and Mike on Matatrex, but a question of free will in interest in Bajor. Because again, if the prophets have gone back retroactively, chosen Sisko to be the emissary, and if I'm proposing in this episode, they're making sure that he stays on track, maybe they're influencing his interest in Bajor in the first place. Maybe they are guiding his study of culture, of religion, of everything Bajor.
That's true. I also think that, I mean, Harry Potter does this really well at the very last book where, you know, Harry realizes that he's been raised all his life to be a certain thing, but he also realizes that it's the free will he has to choose to make that happen, and that he's the kind of person, because of who he is, he'll make the choice to do that. So he does have the choice, but he also doesn't have the choice, so it's the both and. Very scriptural in that sense. And I think Sisko has that too. You know, there is that both and. Sisko has the choice not to choose these things, but because of who Sisko is, he will choose them. So it's not, he's using his free will, but he's a person who is genuinely, it seems to be very curious about the world around him. And it seems like the prophets chose well when they do choose Benjamin Sisko. And it's very clear from Emissary where Sisko is so systematically and, you know, I think fatherly towards these people who don't understand corporeal existence and time, linear time. And it's the way he walks them through that that I think gives them the key to say, okay, well, this is the dude. You know, and no, I don't mean like, you know, the dude from that movie that I can't remember the name of right now. So,
dude.
A
moment ago, you talked about the Bajoran culture and what it was like before the occupation, before the Federation came. And something interesting was said about this episode by Ronald D. Moore. And I don't know that I completely agree with this. They're talking about the Prime Directive. And someone mentioned on Memory Alpha that you could see Sisko's actions in this episode as being a gross violation of the Prime Directive, Sisko's acceptance of his role as emissary of the prophets. And Ronald D. Moore said, "It's a classic example of what not to do. The Starfleet captain who encounters the primitive culture and declares himself a god, that has to be something they teach Starfleet Academy students in their first year. So certainly when they start hearing that somewhere out on the frontier, Ben Sisko is now being revered as a spokesperson for the prophets, it probably would raise a lot of eyebrows back at headquarters." So I guess Ronald D. Moore here is talking more about Admiral Whatley's position, right? Coming out there to check on it and find out what's going on. Of course, Sisko hasn't declared himself a god. The Bajorans have declared Sisko a god. Sisko, as we're talking about, gradually comes around to accepting his role. I don't think he ever sees himself as a god, but he comes to accept that I am this to the Bajoran people. I may be just a human, but in their eyes, I am this figurehead. But the other question is about violating the Prime Directive. The Bajoran culture had warp capability centuries, if not millennia, before humans did. the fact that when you look at the culture now, it doesn't look so technologically advanced does not negate the fact that it is technologically advanced. So does the Prime Directive apply here in the first place?
No, I don't think any of those things apply. I think that's a gross mischaracterization of his own show.
The Prime Directive.
Yeah,
it's a misunderstanding of what the Prime Directive is.
Right. One, because, like you said, these people have warp capability, have immense technology. They understand the universe in ways that Starfleet doesn't necessarily understand it. And yet they also have intense faith as well. And they're the ones who have thrust their faith on the captain and said, no, you are this. And I think that's what's so interesting is that Sisko comes to accept that belief in himself and the idea that he actually not just is to the Bajoran people, but actually is the emissary. And that's his choice to choose to be that person to them and believe that he actually is that. And I do think that, again, this shows the intolerance of Starfleet to the idea that anything supernatural can't be, like, that there's always something scientific, that there is nothing supernatural that you could never explain by natural means. And it's I think it just kind of shows a lack of imagination for them to say, hey, you know what, we don't know, we may never know, but who are we to say this is wrong? I mean, think about that too. They're judging an entire society and say, oh no, you're... What they're thinking in their heads, you know, the Starfleet officers like Dax and O'Brien, especially here in the episode, they're kind of thinking that these people are stupid. You can tell they're not saying that, but they find this idea of faith and trust in the prophets kind of ridiculous.
Stupid or naive. I mean, it depends. I don't think that they don't think that Worf and Kira are stupid. But they think that maybe they're being naive in their understanding of how the universe works is maybe how I would say it.
Well, yeah, in that though, they have placed themselves and their understanding of the universe above Kira and Worf's as if they're better because they think the universe is only scientific.
Which is what we see on a bigger scale in the hands of the prophets between Keiko
and
Wynn, right?
Yeah, and so I love that there is this happening, and I think that's what's going on in this episode and a much better understanding of it, other than trying to make it about some kind of Prime Directive thing or about a Starfleet captain declaring himself a god, which, again, Sisko's never done. Role was thrust upon him. It's not something he even asked for.
Right. I think in the quote I read from Ronald D. Moore, I think that maybe the intention that he had there was through the eyes of Starfleet, here's the classic example of a Starfleet captain who's gone and declared himself a god, as opposed to Ronald D. Moore saying that that's what I think happened, because obviously he's part of the writing staff, so he knows where they're going with it. But through the eyes of Starfleet, that's what they are seeing. And then Admiral Whatley comes out here to find out just what's going on. Now, the person on Memory Alpha who wrote the thing about this being a gross violation of the Prime Directive, that is just a misunderstanding of the Bajoran culture and the Prime Directive, because the Bajoran culture had the technology long before humans were even in space. And so humans are not coming there violating the Prime Directive. It's not a primitive culture, right? The Bajorans are not a primitive culture. They're actually a very mature culture that has moved beyond our technological phase and found a way to have balance in their lives again. Of course, there was the occupation, but as I've said before here and on the Ready Room, I think they had already gone through that process before the Cardassians ever came.
Well, I mean, yeah, and I think that's clear because what we know from their history, you know, they're thousands of years more advanced than humans are, and their culture has been growing for a lot longer, and therefore, they are, and I think that is also something to be said by whoever wrote that in Memory Alpha, which is to say that you can't be an advanced culture and still have spirituality and or a religion and a belief in a higher being power that's a gross mischaracterization of religion in the first place, and again, a placing one view of the universe above the other, and basically making one belief better than the other. That's disappointing.
It does imply that if you have spirituality, then you're primitive.
Exactly, which is, yeah. You know what? I have spirituality, and I still own a lot of technology. So,
yeah. I mean, not everyone thinks that way, but some people do. And that's the impression that I often get in those situations. So what did you think while we're talking about that scene? What did you think about Worf's comment about faith? Was that in character for him, or did that seem a little bit odd?
Actually, that scene, I felt like that scene was perfect. I was rewatching it today, and I just felt like, especially what we've talked about with Worf and Deep Space Nine and how they really deepen the character and the understanding of Klingons, I think that they took all of that and they just really built that in so that when he says that, it's not surprising that it's coming from Worf, who has only shown himself to be very deeply spiritual in the Klingon beliefs. He doesn't necessarily talk about it all the time, but this is a point where I felt like he felt comfortable with coming in and subtly and wonderfully defending Kira and her belief system. Now, Worf doesn't believe the same thing, but he has an intense faith, to which is very personal to him, and he understands exactly what the captain's doing and where Kira's coming from. And so I just thought it was a wonderful way to find the balance in that scene, because you have two and two on each side. Mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, it helped O'Brien and Dax respect more Kira's, you know, what she was saying. Because if Worf is saying that too, it's like, huh, well, maybe I need to rethink the way that I'm thinking about things. And so I
just thought added another angle to it. What I did like in the writing was that when he's asked, "I thought you didn't believe in the prophets," he doesn't say, "I don't, but what I do believe in is faith." He just says, "What I believe in is faith." He never says whether he does or does not believe in the prophets. Now, it's implied, of course, that he doesn't believe in the prophets. But the fact that he doesn't just explicitly say it was nice in the writing. And I think it added that sort of element of doubt for Jadzia and Miles. And to see that, you know, it's not a this or that. Right. It's not black or white. There are maybe other angles to consider.
Well, and I mean, even if he doesn't believe that they're his gods, I think Worf has a clear understanding that the prophets are something out there, and whether or there's not something. He believes in them as gods, yeah. The Bajorans do, and he can completely understand that for what he believes with his Klingon beliefs. And therefore, he is able to respect that and take it on faith that if that's also what the captain believes, then the captain needs that faith. So I think, again, it's a very nuanced discussion and a very nuanced look at faith and all of this that I think is just pretty wonderful.
Now, Worf has said before that the Klingons killed all their gods.
That is true.
And so I guess that's part of what it is for me, is that by things that Worf has said in the past, it feels that the Klingons don't really respect the idea of gods, that they see themselves as being in control in any situation. So, and the idea of faith for Klingons, like when they go into battle, I don't really think of Klingons having faith that they're going to win. They're just, I'm going to go in, I'm going to fight. If I die, that's great, it will be glorious. If I win, that's great, it'll be glorious. It's a little bit different than, you know, my personal view of faith and how things will turn out. But it certainly works for this scene, no doubt there. Let's touch on one more thing before we wrap up here. And this is the idea that there's something worth dying for, because Sisko is willing to give his life to have complete clarity, a full understanding of what it is the prophets are trying to tell him.
This is the interesting thing, and this is again where we kind of came down to, you know, respecting what somebody believes, and Sisko is willing to give up his life for what he feels like is a very important message that the prophets are trying to give him. And again, obviously, anybody who is willing to give up their life for their belief system, I think, truly believes it. You know, a lot of people would say that that is one of the proofs of the apostles in the New Testament. You know, this is a lie. Why would you die for it? Just go back to your carpentry and your, you know, fishermanness. You know, there's no reason to, you know, end up being crucified upside down talking about a lie. Mm-hmm. And so for Sisko, you can really tell that this is a true belief at this point. And, you know, what you're willing to die for says a lot about what you believe. And, you know, what I thought was really cool that Sisko is willing to die for is not just the clarity, but it's because it's affecting the Bajoran people. He's willing to give his life for others. And I think that's a very noble thing. His understanding isn't just for himself. It is for the benefit of the Bajorans. And I think that speaks very highly of Captain Sisko and the belief to which the prophets are encouraging him. And, you know, any belief system that is one that encourages self-sacrifice for the betterment of others, you know, I think that's a worthy and an honorable system of belief.
Hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting take on it. I don't know if I read it that way completely. I feel it's more of Sisko's personality is sometimes a bit obsessive. I go back to Explorers when he's building the ship, and he essentially builds this entire ship by himself in his spare time, but he's going to finish it, right? You think about his obsession with cooking. You think about, well, it's sort of Avery Brooks's personality coming through as well, I think, when I think about his music.
Just luckily, but there's no piano in the, you know, ops. Well,
it's too bad there's not. I mean, what would have been awesome is if he had gone down, he found Bahala, he went in there, and there was an ancient Bajoran piano there. And somehow, it came to him in a vision. He remembered all of the most popular Bajoran songs from the time. And he started playing those on the piano and singing. It would have been awesome. It would have been fantastic. But
yeah. I mean, I can't wait for the Bajoran Spring Wine Lullaby.
It's actually a jingle from the TV commercials of the time, Matthew, for the Spring Wine Company. So.
Bajoran Spring Wine can't be beat. It may cheats meal a special treat.
Yes. Exactly. But anyway, going back to what I'm saying here, though, is I think that the obsession fits well with Sisko's personality. And I don't know if I feel quite as much that he's doing it for the Bajoran people and he's going to sacrifice himself for the Bajoran people as much as it's just that it's like a puzzle for him, and he's unraveling this mystery, and he's almost there, and the prophets are also driving him, because again, I think this is a time where the prophets have sort of taken control a bit, and they're making sure that everything stays on course, and they want him to fully understand the message that they're trying to give him as well, and that naturally means that he's pushing himself all the way to the end. He's sort of under the control of the prophets, I think. That's just how I read it. And I think what you say makes perfect sense as well. And if he has fully accepted that he is the emissary and that his purpose in existence is to guide the Bajoran people safely through the dangers that they're facing, then it does make sense that he would be pushing himself to the very end in order to help those people.
Well, and I think
for me, it doesn't come through quite as clearly in the episode, though.
Right. No, and I completely think that both of them can be at work. You know.
Yeah. All of it can.
You know,
be
I don't think one's right or wrong. I think what you're saying makes complete sense as well, and it's probably just a combination of the two.
Yeah, or the three, if you include the fact that the prophets are controlling him.
Well, there you go, the
it's
trifecta.
His obsession, and he's trying to help the Bajoran
people. It's like
people.
The Bermuda Triangle where everything comes together.
Yeah, it's sort of like a spiritual hat trick.
Oh, man. I love scoring. It's my favorite time of day when I get that, you know, spiritual hat trick. It's wonderful.
It usually happens later in the day, right? Because you need enough time for three things to happen.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, it's very rarely you can get one before 10 a.m.
That's right. And if you've done three impossible things today, why not top it off with dinner at Milliway's, the restaurant at the end of the universe?
I love the restaurant at the end of the universe. Really good salmon.
Excellent salmon, yes. that just reminds me that the book that was written about Douglas Adams after he passed away was called The Salmon of Doubt.
Yes, yes.
All right. Well, I think we've pretty much run through the whole episode. Do you have any final thoughts, anything maybe with the final conversations between Wynn and Kira?
That was a really interesting conversation, and I think that's probably just a whole other show talking about that. Just that one conversation about her saying that, you know, she knew who her enemies were beforehand.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
It's a really interesting thing, and I was thinking in my head as I listened to her say that, I was like, what is she trying to say there? Was she saying that she used to think Sisko was her enemy and now she doesn't?
Yeah.
I guess that's what she's saying.
That is what she's saying.
So, okay. Well, there you go.
Well, I think that is what she's saying, but I think that her position was to keep Bajor out of the Federation, and Sisko represented the Federation, and therefore that alone positioned him as the enemy. But also, she never believed that he was the emissary. She thought he was an imposter, and therefore, to protect her people, he's also the enemy. Now, we know that when, I think, at least by the time we meet her in the hands of the prophets, she's already not a true believer. But I don't think she had quite the devious aspirations that she has later in the series. At that point in time, she just wanted to be the leader. But later on, it sort of spirals into worse intent. But I think here, yeah, she saw the Federation and Sisko as the enemy. Now she's not so sure. But I think that also speaks to the fact that when you have a particular view, and we see this in our world today where things are so incredibly polarized, that if you take the time to think for yourself, to get information from multiple sources, including sources that you don't agree with, and you put it all together, you realize that, just like Deep Space Nine, life is gray. It's not black and white, and things become unclear, just like they do to Wynn at the end of this story, and you're no longer quite sure who's right and who's wrong and who's on your side and who's not on your side, and maybe the people that you think are against you really aren't. Maybe they can help you. You don't know. Things become jumbled.
I mean, you may find that you may believe as many as six impossible things before breakfast if you do that, you know?
That's right.
What I love about that, though, is what you're saying, Chris, is this idea that Wynn has always seen things in this very black and white, and part of that is because she has always been about herself, but she is challenged with something to which she cannot deny, which is this thing that's happened with the emissary and the prophets, and she's seen it with her own eyes happen. And it's that thing of when you finally have an experience with something, you know, whether it's with a person of a certain creed or a certain race, that changes your thought process about them. And when I think about the world which we live in today, how important is it for us to stop and think and consider the other side?
Yeah.
And put ourselves in that side's shoes.
And you people know? Don't do it, and people on both sides don't do it.
You're right, exactly. Yes. And we're all guilty of it. So, you know, don't hear me preaching if I'm just preaching to the, you know, other people listening. No, to ourselves.
Yeah, we all need to do it. We all need to stop and consider all the different angles of an issue.
Yeah, just stop for a minute and think, and you know, and instead of reacting, because that's always our, and that's what's so interesting here is that Wynn doesn't just immediately snap react. That emotionalism doesn't get the better of her. This is the only time I think really in the series where Wynn contemplates, and that conversation with Kira is one of utter confoundedness. She doesn't understand, but it's not a snap reaction. And I mean, gosh, that's all we live in today is snap reaction. Somebody says something online, so I immediately type something back without even thinking about what they're saying or why they said it, or do I even care? Do I even need to respond? Just go about my day, you know? So I love that. That's really fantastic, Chris. And it's great that Deep Space Nine, as we've talked about so many times, is still so relevant because these issues are so fundamental to the human race. And isn't that what Star Trek's about? The human condition.
Exactly. Yeah, it's so... just watching this episode before we did the show, you realize just how relevant the stories on DS9 are today. In some respects, even more so than they were when they were written, which is really incredible. All right. Well, Matthew, I'm glad we got to talk about Rapture finally here on The Orb. I still can't believe we had not done that before. Again, everyone, go listen to the Ready Room 145, Visions from an Alien God, if you want to hear more talk about Rapture. Again, that was from June 18th, 2014. I had to look it up, but it's there. And Rapture is not the only thing we've been talking about here on the network, though, recently. So here's a quick look at some of our other discussions.
Previously on Trek.fm. The Ready Room.
You know, Star Trek All Access gives you a great acronym, though.
STAR!
STAR, yeah.
Yes.
STAR!
Yeah, the upward angle on the... Yeah, totally get it.
To the journey! He tweets out, you know, like, hey, walking around with my mobile emitter, you know, hashtag blessed. You know, it's just... I'm sure that's what he's doing.
Oh, gosh. yep, he's... He's taking photos of his holographic non-dinner.
Continuing mission.
If you notice, my guest star in that one was Doug Drexler himself.
Yes.
One of the great Star Trek minds, Doug Drexler, he kind of changed the lines a little bit to actually be what he thought would have been in a Starfleet inquest.
Saturday Morning Trek.
What I had to assure the fans when I talked at the convention or conventions was this is not going to be a kiddie show. This is not going to be a baby show. We are doing Star Trek. And we were able to do Star Trek in some ways a better way because we could have wonderful spaceships, we could have wonderful aliens, wonderful planets, and we still had good stories.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find us everywhere you get your podcasts. Of course, you can get the shows on our website. You can stream from those show pages. You can download the MP3 files. But if you're an iTunes user, check out our artist section in the iTunes store. We are a featured content provider with Apple. Just go to itunes.com/TrekFM, and that'll take you right over there. You can get every podcast, and we have 25 of them now, as individual feeds. And also we have the master feed, which contains every episode of every show that we do. While you're there in iTunes, please take a moment and leave us a star rating and a written review. We love to hear what you think about the show. And that also helps other Star Trek fans find the show as they're searching for Star Trek podcasts in the iTunes store. If you're not an iTunes user, you can find us in many other places as well. We're on Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, BlackBerry, SoundCloud. We're now in Google Play Music. So if you're an Android user, just search for The Orb. Just search for Trek.fm in your Google Play Music app, and we should come right on up. There are so many ways to get our shows. We put them out there in every place that we can. We want to make it easy for you to listen to all our podcasts here on Trek.fm. So check it all out. If you'd like to share your feedback on today's show, there are a number of ways for you to do that. Matthew, tell everyone how they can get in touch with us.
You can go to trek.fm/contact, just choose a show. You can choose the orb. That email comes straight to Chris and I. You can also go to Twitter at TrekFM, and we're also on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. And, of course, we have the listeners-only discussion group, which is the Babel Conference. So if you're on Facebook, just go to the search field there, type Babel into the search field, or if you're on our website at trek.fm, hit discussion on the menu bar, and that'll bring you straight to the group.
And Matthew, I'd also like to thank our associate producers here on The Orb who make it possible for us to get the show out to everyone each time. There's Ruth Ward, Will Wynn, Ken Tripp, William Murray, and Kay Elizabeth Janeway. And since the last time we recorded, William and Kay are both new associate producers here on The Orb.
Woohoo!
So William and Kay, we have a bottle of spring wine for you as well as an Orb experience.
Or root beer, just depends on which one you like best.
Or root beer, yeah. I mean, you're human, so you might go for the root beer. But if you hang around on Bajor long enough, you're going to really get into the spring wine.
It's true. I mean, why do you think I keep trying to import it here?
We've got the logo done. We're just waiting on the licenses to clear.
Man, it's taking forever, bureaucracy. Yeah,
you know how the bureaucracy is. But yes, thank you, Ruth, Will, Ken, William, and Kay, for your support. And if you'd like to become an associate producer of The Orb, you can do that by supporting us on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you can find out everything you need to know about how to support not only The Orb, but all the shows we have here on the network. Trek FM is a listener-supported network, and we do need your help to keep everything going. It costs a great deal of money every month just to host the files and get them out to you guys, to say nothing of production. And any support you can give us is greatly appreciated, and it does make it possible for us to publish the 3 to 4 episodes we publish every single day here on the network. So thank you so much to everyone who supports us there at patreon.com/trekfm. I'd also like to invite everyone to get your Trek FM merchandise. We have wonderful t-shirts, including, as we've been talking about, the Spring Wine Company logo. Our art director, Aaron Harvey, created that a while back. It is available in our store on t-shirts and many other items. And we now have an easier link for everyone to get to the store. Just go to trekfm.store. That's the URL. trekfm.store. And that'll take you straight over there to Redbubble, and you can get all the merchandise that you like over there. And we get a very small, actually, kickback from that stuff. Most of the money goes into actually producing the stuff, but we do get a little bit from each item purchased, and that, again, helps us keep the network going. So we do thank you for purchasing from the Trek FM store and invite you to check out all the merchandise over there. Now, Matthew, when you're not pretending to be having an orb vision so your boss will leave you alone at the office, where can people find you?
What? I'm sorry, Chris. What did you say?
I'm sorry. Did I wake you up before the end?
No. Story? Orb vision, Chris. Orb vision. Oh, gosh. No, everybody can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. Of course, I'm here on the network doing Literary Treks with Dan and Bruce, where we talk about the books and the comics of Star Trek. We also get the opportunity to interview the authors a lot of times. It's so much fun. You can find me doing our general geek show, the 602 Club, which just is a complete blast. We're talking about all the other fandoms that we love beyond Star Trek, and not beyond Star Trek, the new movie, but it's confusing now. I can't even say that anymore, because Beyond has ruined that, Chris. And then, of course,
<I'm> sorry.
you can also find me on Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills. That's a Star Wars podcast, and just search that in iTunes, and you will find that there. So, now, Chris, when you're not trying to rustle up another bottle of spring wine, even though you should probably lay off the sauce, where can we find you?
Yeah, I do need to lay off the sauce. You know, I'm thinking the way I'll do that slowly is I'll stop the spring wine and I'll just get on the Yamek sauce for a while, because Quark has a lot of it laying around.
Just not the same effect, really, though.
No, it's a little bit too thick to drink, but hey, yeah, you know, I'm going to roll with it. You can find me elsewhere on the network doing The Ready Room, which I mentioned a couple of times today. That's a show where we talk about all 5 live-action Star Trek series, and we rotate through, starting with the original series. We go all the way through to Enterprise, and then we go back to TOS, We also talk about other topics from time to time, and we have a news segment. Matthew's on there with me occasionally. Larry Nemechek is on there quite often as well, and many other hosts from around the network and some other special guests. So check out that show if you want to hear about every corner of Star Trek. You can also find me occasionally doing our short news show, Hyperchannel. And then you can find my writing about Star Trek over on the official website at StarTrek.com. Just search for my name, C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And those articles will come up. And you can use C. Brian Jones to find me on Twitter, on Facebook, pretty much anywhere in social media. That's the name I use everywhere. And then, of course, I'm there in the Babel Conference also. So come on over and check out all the rest of the Star Trek discussion, and I'd love to chat with you over there.
Well, thank you everyone so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time as we gaze into the orb.